Bridge at Large. We're going to talk about cash flow statements, and Andrew's going to say some
words. Okay, thanks very much indeed, Stephen. To avoid any confusion, I should state that I'm here in my capacity as a member of the staff of the FRC.
Due to the small number of remaining conferences, this conference will be broken down in 40 minutes. Enter star 1 to cancel and continue the conference.
Well, let's see if we can go 40 minutes without breaking down. When you look in the lunch hour, and it says on each page this paper is recycled, some of you may have felt that the information on cash flow was a bit recycled, because we have discussed it with both CMAC and the GPF before around the end of 2014. The work has been on pause for various reasons, but we're now reaching a phase where we'd really like to get something out of the door reasonably quickly. Certainly, I would hope, by the end of the year. So let me just recap a little. The FRC undertook this work following the IESB's agenda consultation. That, of course, is not the one that's just ended, but the one that took place around 2011. In the feedback from that agenda consultation was a list of research projects where IESB welcomed initiatives from national standard setters. So I took a paper to our accounting council, showed them the list, and made some recommendations, which were not accepted. They wanted to do work on cash flows. And that, I think, reflects the importance of certainly our council attaches to information on cash flow, and that's what we've been doing ever since. The aim of the project is to stimulate debate and try to find out what people's views are. The paper deliberately contains what it calls suggestions. At the moment, they're not even proposals. They're certainly not firm positions of anybody, not the FRC, and certainly not the IESB. But we think this is a timely initiative to get this out about now. The IESB has a statement, has its project on primary financial statements, and that includes the cash flow statement. And so it could be provide some timely input to that. I would stress that we haven't tried to cover every possible issue that would need to be considered if one were to develop a new standard on cash flow statements. In particular, we've tried to avoid duplicating other people's work. EFRAG have been doing work on the cash flow statement for financial institutions, and IESB is looking at disclosures about restrictions on cash. So they're not in the paper and not on the agenda for this afternoon. A bit of a word about the objective of the cash flow statement. Now, when we took it to the CMAC all those months ago, the paper as drafted said, well, the objective is not to give information on performance. And some people felt that was a bit of a strange thing to say and didn't exactly agree with it. We've now recast that slightly. And what we're really trying to say is that whatever the objective is, it's not to try to put earnings onto a cash basis and give you a cash measure of earnings in place of the accruals-based one. Rather, it's to give information on liquidity. And that has some quite important consequences, or certainly the thinking that cash flow is about a cash measure of earnings does have some important consequences for the way that IS7 and, of course, FAS 95, which it closely resembles, are based. In particular, earnings is obviously after interest and after tax, and it's also a default measure. And we're not sure that, well, the paper suggests that doesn't really lead to the best way of classification. So we've made some proposals about how, in three areas, and these are the three areas on which we'd like to get your views during the breakout sessions and in the feedback. The first of these is the classification of cash flows. Cash flow from operations is clearly a very important number. Having said that, it's a bit strange that IES7 regards it as the default category. So if you've got anything that you can't neatly fit into investing or into investing or into financing, then it ends up within operations. If operations is an important number, we think it should be defined or at least described. And items that are not operating should not be reported within operations if they don't meet the definition of operating, and also, of course, if they're not investing or financing, then they should be reported in a separate category. Another suggestion in this area concerns expenditure on property, plant and equipment, which I still prefer to call fixed assets. Under IAS 7, they're regarded as investing activities. So your cash flow from operations never includes an amount in respect of that expenditure. The suggestion in the paper is that it should be within operating activities, but we recognise that it's likely to be somewhat volatile, i.e. the amount will change significantly in different periods. And for that reason, we suggested there should be a subtotal of other operating activities. And of course, it gives rise to the question of how do you can you distinguish expenditure of that kind, which is replacement, from that which is expansion of activities? And we discuss that and conclude that it's really quite difficult to improve on what IAS 7 does at the moment, which is simply to encourage entities to make that disclosure. Interest under IAS 7, you've got a range of choices as to whether you put it in operating or financing and investing. The paper discusses this in some depth and actually is rather sceptical about whether interest is really a concept that has anything to do with cash flows. It's got an awful lot to do with accruals accounting, where you need to decide whether a payment is in fact income and expense or a change of capital. But from a cash flow perspective, it's just a cash flow. And so the question is, which of your activities does it relate to? And so interest on debt is proposed to be within financing activities, and that's probably most interest, of course. But other interest, for example, if you make sales to your customers on deferred terms, then the cash flows that you collect from them would be within operating activities. Final point on classification is that we suggest that tax should be dealt with in a separate section rather than dealt with in IAS 7, which requires it to be within operating unless it is clear unless and to the extent that it is clear it belongs somewhere else. The second area that we'd like your views on this afternoon is the issue of what is cash, or as IAS 7 has it, cash and cash equivalents. There's a rather loose definition of that in IAS 7, which seems to be designed to try to get information on how people manage their cash or near cash investments. We discuss that and conclude that actually people are free to manage their liquidity in whatever way they like, and it would seem appropriate for the cash flow statement to reflect that. To do that, the suggestion is that we would have quite a tight definition of cash, and cash flow should mean flows of cash, essentially cash and cash at banks. But there should be a separate section setting out how liquid resources are managed. And then that gives rise to the question of, well, what is a liquid resource? Well, a liquid resource, we suggest, is any resource which is liquid, which means it's readily convertible into cash. We'd propose relaxing some of the restrictions in IAS 7, which say about not accepting price risk, because after all, if you think the best use for your money is to invest in something highly speculative, then why shouldn't you do it? It remains liquid. So we're not going to make any, with the proposal, the suggestion is not to make any other restrictions, but to require disclosure. The third area on which we'd like your views this afternoon is about the reconciliation of operating activities. Again, IAS 7 is drafted in a rather odd way when you come to look at it. It is clear that a reconciliation of operating profits and operating cash flow is required, well, is necessary if you're using the indirect method. The way it's described in IAS 7, I personally find very hard to interpret as to whether it's telling you how to do it or whether it's telling you what to disclose. But we know from the research we've carried out that the reconciliation gives very valuable information. Particularly, it gives an insight into what's sometimes referred to as the quality of earnings, because it can show how operating profits relate to cash flow from operations, and if there are big differences. That seems to be something that people would find quite useful. For that reason, we're suggesting that the reconciliation should be required in all cases, not just when an indirect method cash flow statement is presented. Now, I've left to last the question that people usually think of first in relation to the cash flow statements: should it be direct or indirect? And that's quite deliberate, because it seems to be a very odd debate. It's an odd debate in the sense that it talks about how people should prepare information, or at least reads that way sometimes, when really the debate should be about what information is disclosed. Our conclusion is that we should focus on disclosure requirements, and if there are particular line items, and cash collected from customers is clearly is one which is often mentioned, then that should be required by a standard, but that a standard needn't prescribe either the direct or the indirect method. It's more a question of what is disclosed. So with that very brief overview, I'll conclude my comments, but obviously I'd welcome any questions.
So clarifying questions on Andrew's proposals, it's all pretty specific. We're asking you specific questions, so hopefully it's clear, but questions?
I have a question. When I was reading through the documentation you prepared, and you touched a little bit on direct cash flow at the end, when I read the everything you wrote, is the intent to move away from the direct cash flow?
There is no intent, or at least the paper does not suggest that those who prepare a direct method cash flow should be required to change, or those that prefer to present a direct method cash flow. It's quite interesting that Australia used to require a direct method cash flow statement, and there, when they moved to IFRS, they gave the option, and comparatively few companies have availed themselves of it, so they've continued to present direct cash flow information, and so that in this, the paper suggestions are that that would be allowed to continue, but that there would be no requirement to present a direct method cash flow statement for those who do not prefer to use the indirect method.
That was not really, when you read through the way how you describe direct cash flow, you actually write it a little bit like, and you put additional burden on companies who report direct cash flow with more reconciliation. Mm. It sounds a little bit negative towards the direct cash flow, which sounds for me a little bit irritating, considering that this is most likely the most accurate description of what you describe as being a cash flow. And now I look more around to the users of financial statements, most likely that's what you prefer to see, right? At least that's the feedback which we get from financial analysts when they look on our financial reports.
Why don't you let the users respond to this question first?
So, I mean, for me, the main thing is really being able to reconcile every item I see in the cash flow statement with the P&L and balance sheet. And I think that's really my main challenge. And that's why I generally prefer the indirect method, but even that is very sort of flawed from my perspective. Because the problem is, I mean, a lot of the items from the P&L or from the balance sheet, they're scattered over a lot of different places in the cash flow statements, or some are lumped together into one line. And so, for me, when I model, I do the P&L and then the balance sheet, and then I basically try to put all of the non-cash movements from the P&L and the changes in the balance sheet back through the cash flow statement, and it never quite looks the way the company reports it, and it's very hard for me sometimes to actually look at the lines of the cash flow statement and say what is really behind that. So I think, you know, and that's what I've heard from a lot of users, what we really would like is to have a very clear reconciliation where we can see for each line in the cash flow statements what from the P&L and what from the balance sheet is actually flowing through that.
Okay. a different section of the write-up. When you're talking about the cash flows relating to tax being in a separate section, I don't know what your starting point is in your statement of cash flow or what the impact on your operating section of your cash flow statements is. I guess without knowing how everything fits together or having a model, I'm confused by what this would look like or how the information would flow.
Yeah, I think the main reason for that proposal is that trying to segment your tax charge between a number of activities is inevitably arbitrary. And therefore, rather than give arbitrary information, it seems better to pull it out and leave it for separate analysis. I mean, all these views are, of course, you know, debatable then.
So would that mean you would start with your pre-tax earnings number in your statement of cash flows and have this be a separate section?
Yes, I believe it. Okay. That's the implication.
I just needed explanation to be able to talk about it.
Okay. Yes, one question about the difference between operating activity and investment activity. One example is purchase of intangible assets in the pharmaceutical industry. Normally, we treat it as an investment, same as a stock acquisition of a biotech venture, something like that. But it sounds like the acquisition intangible is regarded as operating activity based on this statement. Is that correct understanding?
I think it is. I know that when we drafted that section of the paper, we focused on the IAS 16 stuff, the PPE, and it was always in my mind that the same arguments would apply to intangibles, and therefore that purchase of intangibles would also be within operating activities. I can't recall now whether we actually remembered to make that quite clear in the paper.
Thank you.
I think it's a discussion paper and thus has a bit more of a long-term look. Have you thought about the impact that future methods of payments, blockchain and other things could have an impact? Because I would have expected, if these new methods of payment become common, I would rather expect we need to think about broadening the cash and cash equivalent definition rather than narrowing it. Because just imagine you settle all your customers settle your claims through new methods of payment, your cash from customers would be zero if you only look at cash, and everything would then be in the section in which you would report transfers between new payment methods and traditional cash, and I don't know whether that would be overly useful.
I think the answer is that we haven't considered that at the moment. It's a point that's been made elsewhere, and so we're thinking about whether we want to, the extent to which the paper might be expanded to address that. But no, you're right, it's not something that's there at the moment.
That might be a topic for us to discuss for future agenda items. That sounds like it's going beyond the intention of this discussion paper, but it sounds an interesting topic in its own right.
Could I just say there that in the agenda consultation we had a couple of requests from the national standard setters for us to look at Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies. The board decided not to do anything with that, but we were going to go back to those two standard setters and ask them if they're aware of any issues and then let us know if they find any. So if you become aware of any that you think we need to think about.
Well, I think maybe the topic currently in practice may be too small. But everyone knows that this will be growing quickly. And the question is, that's why I said the combination of this being a discussion paper, whether you should, for purpose of discussion paper, assume the world to be unchanged in 10 years, or whether you shouldn't think about considering future developments.
Okay, good point. Mitch?
The question I had was just to better understand the rationale for putting CapEx, which is financing long-term assets, into cash from operating section. I don't understand that.
Well, essentially the rationale is simply that in order to carry out your operations, you need to acquire property, plant and equipment. And it seems reasonable, therefore, that it should enter into operating cash flow at some point in time. I.e. the point in time at which the cash flow actually occurs. But as I say, we do go on to discuss that probably it should be shown separately within operating, so there'll be a subtotal of everything else before transactions in PP&E, and also that we would encourage companies to distinguish the amount of that expenditure that represents expansion as opposed to replacement.
Kevin?
Sorry, just one thing on the indirect direct method. I can't recall when I've used the financial statement with direct method. In years and years.
When we have this discussion, yeah. I know direct indirect is a real touchstone for everybody.
Which is I would
encourage you not to get drawn exclusively into that discussion and try and answer Andrew's questions.
Kevin?
So Andrew, just two questions. One being, I understand why you would want less judgment applied to ensure better comparability for the cash flow standard. But if you're doing a business combination in cash and shares, I don't know how you allocate the cash to whether it's the intangibles, tangibles, or whether it's something else. And on the fixed assets one, being in the mining industry where it takes me 5 or 6 years to bring an asset into fruition, my CapEx is financed through debt and shares. It's not financed through operating. It would be very misleading to say that my operating activities, which my shareholders demand dividends on, is actually being used to build my new mines, which are not even expansion, it's just maintaining current production.
Okay, I think we're getting into some of the questions that Andrew's asking, which we're going to discuss in the breakout session. So any more sort of clarifying questions now? Okay, you'll see. But Mary, you wanted to say something?
I just wanted to point out that the last couple of pages of the long paper, the draft discussion paper,
it has a profile.
Has a before and after of what a statement of cash flows might look like in terms of giving people a sense of, you know, what might a starting point be, et cetera, et cetera.
I think Mary's made me confess that after we sent out the papers, we had the auditors in, and some of the numbers in that example don't seem to be quite right, but it does show you the shape of how it would change. So
if you were to audit the numbers, Marietta, did you have another question?
Yeah, just one very high level question. So it sounds like we're supposed to come up with really strong views as to what goes into operating cash flow as opposed to other segments of cash flow. But we don't really have a definition of what operating profit is, so I'm just trying to understand, you know, how these two sort of interlink, and you know, what we should use as guidance, and what the implications would be for the operating profit.
Yes, and we will be talking about that later. But yeah, well, your views on that as well will be welcome. But yeah, absolutely. Okay, right, let's go to our breakout rooms then and continue the conversation.